You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.
Well, hello, everybody, and welcome to another fantastic episode of Around the Block. I'm Bruce Cameron, along with Susan Giddings. I know that some of you were tempted to watch the Sentencing Commission streaming live, but I can assure you, you made the right choice by coming here, if you're coming here, because I just don't think anything's going to happen overnight over there in the Sentencing Commission. Anywho, well, we had posted a question here to our members of our Facebook group, First Step Act Early Release from Federal Prison Facebook group. And so I know Susan wants to address those. We're going to talk about transfers possibly and some other things. So without further ado, I get a pass.
Yeah. Okay, so let's start fresh because I did not hear what you were saying because I was turning on and off.
There's nothing. Just go. Yep.
All right. So when talking about, you know, the first question was asked, you know, Bruce started to talk about it, was about transferring from maximum security to medium security. So my first thing I'm going to say is, let's talk about the security levels, because maximum security is actually what within the Bureau, we talk about those control units, those lockdown units. Think Florence, Colorado, the administrative max facility, or for the very, very tiny number of females, the administrative max facility, the administrative max unit at Carswell. From medium, we go to high security. Now, is it possible for someone to be in a high security prison with medium points? Yes.
Yes.
The most common reason for that is sentence length. One of the things the Bureau has is what they call public safety factors. Public safety factors automatically increase someone's security level in terms of where they're designated to, regardless of their point structure. We see this a lot of times with individuals in low security facilities who are unable to go to a camp because they have a greater severity public safety factor. They have an alien or non-US citizen public safety factor. Maybe they have a sex offender public safety factor. Those are all things that it doesn't matter how low your points are, you're not going to a camp without what's known as a public safety factor waiver. So what can impact a person with medium points sitting in a high security facility? Could be sentence length public safety factor. That's a common one. That occurs when an individual has more than 30 years remaining to serve on their sentence. That's not a 30-year sentence, but 30 years still left to serve.
To serve. So they can't be in a medium. They can't be in a medium, right?
Without a waiver. Unless they have a public safety factor waiver. Now, one of the things that happened, let's jump back to FSA for a second. One of the things that was put out by the agency late in the summertime or early fall, I can't recall it at the moment, I think it was late summer, is that for custody classification purposes, they would use the conditional release information. What does that mean? That means someone who is sitting in a penitentiary because of their sentence length, but is doing well, is earning time credits. And remember, security level and pattern risk level are two different things. You can be sitting in a penitentiary and earning your time credits. So for those individuals, the Bureau has said, hey, we're going to use that information. If you are actively in earning status, and you have earned time credits that reduces your sentence, we're going to look at that conditional date information and we're going to give you that benefit. So that's one area. Another area that is common for elevating individuals to a penitentiary is that disruptive group membership. Now that is a very, honestly, a small group of people. It applies to individuals who are validated members of certain specific disruptive group organizations. It's not gang membership across the board. It's just specific gang organizations that if you're a validated member of, it's going to bump you to a penitentiary. Now, if those aren't going on and a person is still sitting at a medium security facility, my next guess is there's something going on that they've added a management variable. Either you're very new to the system, your points were just updated, maybe they just validated some information regarding a high school diploma or some resolved pending charges, but you've only been there literally a couple of months. They are unlikely to move you until you've been there at least 12 months. So they may have requested a management variable to hold right. you pending some resolution of obviously some other things. If those, and you and I talk about it all the time in terms of designation and custody classification, and it's those little things that can tick those points up, and getting them resolved and getting your points back down is really important. So it could be that. It could also be misconduct. Someone who is medium security, but maybe even with the incident reports, they're still medium security level, but maybe they've gotten several incident reports, several low-level incident reports, and it is, they're being disruptive. They're not doing what they need to do. Maybe
low level meaning 300 series, 400 series?
Level series, not showing up to work, refusing an order, being just generally disruptive, but on that kind of low level stuff, right? That's okay. The kind of thing that if you're sitting in a penitentiary and your points drop to the medium security level, but you can't behave, they are not going to reward bad behavior. Okay, even when it's low level behavior. So if you're sitting in a penitentiary, you're sitting right on the cusp of being medium security, it is in your best interest to program and stay out of trouble, even the little things. You know, being insolent is another example. When you mouthing off to a staff member, it's a low level incident report. It's nonviolent in the scope of everything. It's not going to be held against a person for this extended period of time. But if you're right on the cusp of being able to go to a medium security facility, but you have recent misconduct, and I mean the last 2, 3, 4, 6 months, you're likely not going to get a transfer. And they're going to ask for a management variable to allow you the opportunity to demonstrate some good behavior, demonstrate some good responsibility before they're going to move you down.
Now, Susan,
things that can happen.
Now, you've worked in a penitentiary and
11 years.
And 11 years in a penitentiary, and you've seen this firsthand. So, did you ever advise wardens and whatever, like, hey, let's go ahead, you know, in terms of those variables or whatever, to free up somebody?
Right. So, when I would be looking at, and kind of this is kind of the normal kind of routing of paperwork. Unit team makes a recommendation. Case manager writes it up. It's signed off by the unit manager. It comes up to what I was, the case management coordinator. And my job is to look at that referral and say, A, is the individual scored correctly? Is the information in here accurate? And is he appropriate for a transfer? Or could there be some concerns? Maybe there's some low-level misconduct that is still scored against them. That was a common reason why I kicked paperwork back. And it usually went back to the unit team with something like, hey, are we sure we want to transfer him? He's had some recent misconduct. If the unit manager wants to discuss the case with the AW, the associate warden, might be a good idea. Because they didn't really address in the referral why we should transfer this individual despite recent misconduct. So I would send it back. Yes.
What about if you happen to be at a complex that has a USP and a medium? Is it easier to kind of take that risk and just write it out on a napkin and send the guy across the street? Or
used to still be. So for many, many years, all of the correctional complexes had the ability to do lesser security transfers, and the warden could sign off on it, and it was a local decision.
Well, that's no more, huh?
Yeah, not long before, was it right before I retired or right after? I don't remember, but it was right around that time in 2024 that those waivers were removed. And honestly, some of the reason it was removed was there was some movement going on that really shouldn't have been going on. There were some issues. So the assistant director at the time over correctional programs made the decision to pull all of them back. And as far as I know, that has not been revisited. There's been obviously we have a different assistant director in correctional programs who his background also includes working in correctional complexes. That hasn't been, as far as I know, has not been revisited. All transfers, even if they're inter-complex transfers, go out to DSCC. And are approved not locally by the warden, but by the DSCC.
And I think that's a good idea to have that check and balance. You know what I mean? You don't want just some local decision like that without having another set of eyes looking at that transfer paperwork. So I see the value in that because
if something does. I'm sorry. The reason it was done originally was to be more efficient, right? Like the warden's right here. It's his people. We're moving him from the USP to the FCI or from the medium to the low or whatever the case is. It was seen as more efficient. It is more efficient when it's still done correctly. And I think perhaps there were some decisions made, not pointing the finger at any one complex, but perhaps there were some decisions made. And the assistant director at the time felt there was a need to kind of rein that back in.
And this would apply to go from low to a camp as well, right? It applies to everybody.
Right? Not exactly. So the policy still allows a warden to move someone to their own satellite camp. It is in-house. It's where, when you move an inter-complex transfer, technically it's still a transfer between institutions, right? FCC Butner has the MDC, has FCI 1, FCI 2, and the low has a satellite camp. The satellite camp isn't a separate facility. It is merely a satellite unit to the low. So for institutions that have those satellite camps, yes, it is still in policy. The warden can make that decision. A lot of wardens don't like to, though, and will choose not to do that, won't want to do that. Even like it's a low in going to the camp, it's one level. A lot of wardens don't seem to like that. And the primary reason is the person has been on the inside and is familiar with inside security, and now we're putting them at an outside satellite facility with that kind of inside knowledge. Okay. So they tend to kind of shy away from that. So for the person that posted the individual question, obviously there's a lot of variables going on. So I'd recommend they give us a call offline separately and discuss the case. And so, When people call us, and sometimes we give them bad news, we're very honest when we're talking to people, and we don't take cases that we don't think we can help. I can't see that.
214-431.
You gotta have a better sign of that. Yeah, it's 214-431-2032.
And just give us a call and we'll explain.
And we'll go through to the detail. When someone calls us, what we do is we ask questions. What was their offense? How much time? Look at their release date. Are they earning time credits? How's their conduct been? And we go through those kind of different questions to determine, is there something going on that we can facilitate in that? And if there isn't, we'll tell you, because we're like that. as I always say, we don't sell sunshine and rainbows. We do give everyone the truth. So we had another really quick question about, we had a couple people asking questions about visitation. We know right now, many of the institutions are still experiencing staff shortages and last minute decisions to cancel visitation happen. If there's any, if there's something going on at the institution in terms of a lockdown or some kind of disruption that is going to, they know visitation is going to be canceled, they ordinarily post that banner on the institution's public website that appears as a kind of a burgundy strip across the top. Unfortunately, we know it happens. They don't have enough coverage on a given morning, and they make the captain and the warden makes that decision to cancel visitation day because they just don't have the coverage. Generally speaking, if you're looking for information on procedures regarding visiting schedules, visiting rules, every institution on their public website, if you scroll down, has a visiting schedule and procedures section. If you click on that link, it's going to take you to the institution's institution supplement, which discusses all of the issues relevant to visitation. And there is variation from institution to institution, so you want to make sure you look at that. Generally speaking, institutions do not have visitation Monday through Friday unless it's a federal holiday. And then, of course, on weekends, on occasion, you will see extra days put in there if the president gives the declares an extra holiday, like the day after Christmas, if that falls, that's a Friday between, you know, Christmas is on Thursday, then that becomes a federal holiday. If it is not a federal holiday, occasionally I've seen institutions, if the staffing was amenable, you might see the day after Thanksgiving. It's generally a liberal leave day. You may see that established as a visitation day, but that is a local decision. And I know we've seen less and less of that with the issues regarding staffing. And there was something else I was going to say about visiting, and it's gone. Yeah, it's gone. Wanted to talk about the halfway house referral process. Had a question someone asked about,
I'm going to read this and I'll weigh in.
Okay.
Is there anything I can do prior to my son's sentencing? We are in the preliminary phase to stay preventative and diligent so that the rest of the process can be more seamless and less bumpy. I have questions. Well, let me tell you, you want to give us a call. ER is your initials, Echo Romeo, female. You want to give us a call because we can help you, especially if the pre-sentence report hasn't been finalized yet. If that PSR is in process or hasn't been done yet, you definitely want to talk to us about the pre-trial situation to see what some of the needs are going to be, what some of the programs will be, and getting that highlighted in the pre-sentence report is going to make your loved one's time less bumpy and more seamless and
100%.
able to earn the FSA credits that they possibly deserve. So definitely, if that pre-sentence report hasn't been done, you want to give us a call, 214-431-2032. Just or hit us back from your Facebook post. Susan, what are your thoughts about that?
So one of the things I would say, even more than the pre-sentence report, is even before that, you know, Bruce and I aren't lawyers and we don't give legal guidance. But I will tell you, when an individual is consulting with their attorney and is looking at federal charges and is contemplating a plea agreement, understanding the First Step Act statutory exclusions is really important. I was sitting at a federal public defenders conference. I was still employed, was going to be speaking on the First Step Act. And that was a topic that came up over and over among the federal public defenders, was having an understanding, if you're counseling someone to take a plea agreement, being aware of what can and won't exclude them statutorily. Now, that doesn't address the risk issue, and we're going to set that aside. But the first hurdle for earning FSA is that offense. And paying attention to that is really important. we provide in our Unlocking Federal Time Credits, we provide a list of the charges that are excludable, that are excluded under the First Step Act that are statutorily excluded. There's also information on the Bureau's page. It's a little, it has a few more links. It's a little more buried. Ours is just Appendix A. And we go through and we talk about, actually we have an entire chapter on eligibility, and we talk about what's on the judgment and commitment order and what sections and subparagraphs impact, how that impacts eligibility. We see all the time, in fact, oddly enough, there was a Supreme Court case not that awful long ago, had nothing to do with FSA, had to do with the dreaded 924C conviction. In this case, the individual was convicted for 924J. 924J is a penalty statute that essentially says, and I'm paraphrasing here, having committed 924C and someone died, right? So it wasn't just use and carrying a firearm, it was use of a firearm and a person died as a result, okay? That 924J, in this particular case, the person, the Bureau, calculated their sentence computation and gave them a consecutive sentence. Why? Because 924C has to be run consecutive. So they interpreted that to mean, well, J says, having been convicted of C and someone died. So therefore, if you're convicted of 924J, you are also required to have a consecutive sentence. The Supreme Court said no. The Supreme Court said Congress only said that the 924C has to be consecutive. Everything else can be consecutive or concurrent at the discretion of the court. It's not the Bureau's place to automatically make it consecutive. And so that's an important thing to remember, is paying attention to that. And so again, if you're in that route, if you're looking at federal sentencing and you're looking at, if you're looking at a federal conviction and you're not even at that point yet of a plea agreement or a conviction, understanding the impact of that actual charge on, as it applies to FSA, the First Step Act, and being able to earn time credits is really important. So, and we talk about that. And so, yes, I would recommend, I think I did post recommending that she give us a call, because there's a lot of details there. I had mentioned the other book we did. And so when you hear us talking about the blue book is the FSA book and the green book is the designation book.
Classification.
A big chunk of that green book is talking about the pre-sentence investigation report and how important that is to smoothing out, when you're looking at time, smoothing out that process, whether it's custody classification and what institution you're going to, whether it's, are you eligible to participate in the residential drug abuse program? Just because the judge recommended it means nothing. You have to be eligible, right? And that information needs to be documented in the pre-sentence investigation report. Even things as simple as how quickly you can get your visitation set up. Are all of your immediate family members listed in your pre-sentence investigation report? If they aren't, then there's a longer process to get visitation for them approved and have them allowed to be able to visit you in custody. So we emphasize over and over again just how important the pre-sentence report is. I can't beat that drum enough.
You know, and it's kind of interesting. Some of these ladies that call us, I'm like, so are you his wife? No. So are you in the pre-sentence report? No. So are you a newcomer? You know what I mean? Through a pen pal. I mean, you know, so it's really interesting. And I want him to live with me and do a change of district, like, oh boy. So, you know, those late breaking life circumstances.
And listen,
post some delays.
You know, the path toward that pretrial path can be very long, and relationships can fall apart and new ones can start. and having them documented appropriately is important. And I can tell you, relationships after the fact are not viewed the same as relationships that are pre-established. When that comes from release plans and probation officers, I mean, some might be more liberally minded than others, but if that's a completely undocumented relationship, they're going to question it. So let's jump over to halfway house. Halfway house and home confinement. So talking about that process, we had a question about how long does it take? Once my loved one has signed their paperwork, how long before we know? Great question. But before you ask that question, I always, and we get this call all the time, and my first question is, well, when you say they signed their paperwork, what paperwork are you talking about, right? So at team, unit team, case manager, they're supposed to talk to a person about their release needs, about their reentry planning, and make a recommendation. And that recommendation is documented on their team sheet, and they sign for that, right? They sign their team sheet. Then there's some forms that go over the rules of halfway house and home confinement that need to be signed and included in the referral packet, and they sign for that. There is a supervised release plan if they have supervision to follow. For those that don't have supervision to follow, you don't have that form, and you sign that. There's a progress report. That's also signed. When someone signs paperwork, what paperwork is the first question? And is it the case manager just called him in and had him sign those conditions of halfway house, conditions of home confinement, and hasn't even started the packet? Or is everything done and they're having them come in and sign those forms along with the progress report and the supervised release plan, because everything else is done and they're getting ready to route the packet? Routing the packet, right, meaning right, moving it through all the different offices in the institution. So the first question always has to be, what paperwork? We encourage our people to ask their case manager, is everything done and you're getting ready to route this to the warden? Or is there more work that still has to be done at your level?
And the other thing is, and you can get to it in a minute if you want, is, oh, I got a date. They gave me a date of such and such. Right. Well, maybe. Is that a date? Is that the date the case manager recommended? Or has it already gone to the regional office? And this is the date that the residential reentry manager has designated for you to go. Right. And that's a big difference between what was recommended and what's actually received from the regional office.
Absolutely. And I would go one step further and say what was recommended versus what was signed off on. Because what the case manager does is they put together that packet of information, and then it goes to the unit manager and to the records office and to the case management coordinator, then the associate warden, and then up to the warden before it's signed. Now, in most cases, right, is everybody going to sign off on what the unit team recommended? Probably. But on the other hand, if the individual is talking to the case management coordinator, talking to the unit manager, talking to the warden at mainline, hey, boss, my unit team only recommended 60 days. Let me tell you what's going on. When my paperwork gets to you, can you take a closer look at it? Can a warden kick it back and say, hey, is 60 days really enough? Absolutely. Right. So knowing, is this the recommendation for the team that the team recommended? Is this the date that the warden signed off on? Or, as Bruce said, is this the date that was returned by the reentry office, who is the final approving authority for dates for halfway house or home confinement? And those are three different things.
Yeah, exactly. We had a, you and I had a call this morning from the Mid-Atlantic area where the inmate had success. You know, the paperwork went through, went to the regional office. But once it hit the regional office, like, nope, no bed space. Here's your new date. And it was months later, right?
Absolutely.
So, you know, that can happen on some of these residential reentry centers that are packed, and you can really get your heart broken by having a fairly significant delay in your date.
Absolutely. And of course, in the case of this particular case we were talking to, we were asking questions about why wasn't home confinement recommended?
Right.
Person exactly. had a verified home plan, probation had been there. Now, are there legitimate reasons for not putting someone in home confinement despite having a valid release plan? Yes. But what is in the policy, and there is a policy on home confinement, and when direct home confinement is not appropriate, that list is pretty small. And so it's a legitimate question to ask. Why wasn't home confinement recommended?
Yeah, I know that's yeah. Did you think that would have gone through?
In right now, you know, the director of the agency has made it very clear that we want to use halfway house. Halfway house is using that bed space for individuals who either can't go to direct home confinement because of issues, or need halfway house. Okay. I'll be the first one to say, just because you have a place to go to doesn't necessarily mean you don't need halfway house. Bruce and I have had this conversation as a case manager. I didn't ask, hey, do you have an address? I wanted to know who are you planning to live with? And yeah, if you're going back to a spouse, a partner, a longtime partner, someone, a relationship that's documented in the PSR, you're going back to your address that you previously lived in before incarceration, yeah, that's probably a pretty stable address. If you're going back to reside with parents, at least in the short term, parents are usually pretty stable individuals in terms of their willingness to accept their adult child back in the home as they are working to kind of get their lives restarted. But other folks, couch surfing on your brother's sofa in his already crowded house is not a release plan. That's a space of last resort, but that is not a release plan. And as a case manager, I didn't just ask for an address. I kind of dug in with my folks, like, okay, what's your plan? You know, and where do you plan to work? Well, I don't have a job. Well, what do you want to do? I had a few too many people who wanted to be sports or musician publicists. I don't recommend that as a job trade. Not to say there aren't some opportunities there, but coming directly out of prison, probably not. But kind of digging in, and unfortunately what we see today is between staff shortages in case management, where you have case managers working very large caseloads or working two caseloads, as well as a lot of the other administrative tasks that have been put on case managers over the years that didn't exist, you know, a decade or two ago. I think we've overburdened the case managers. And so I think what we see is a lot of case managers just working to keep the paperwork going, are not asking a lot of questions, are not digging in because they don't have the bandwidth to do so. That's a different soapbox of mine, but so we won't get into it here, but they're not digging in. So I think it's important for the individuals who are serving the sentence be able to represent their needs very clearly when they're talking to their unit team. And that's something Bruce and I were working toward finalizing a third book. talking about Second Chance Act. And what's one of the things we're going to be digging into is being able to articulate your own release needs and being honest with yourself about your reentry needs and not overinflating your reentry needs because you think if you can show that everything's perfect in your world, that you're going to get more halfway house, which you're not, because halfway house is a needs-based recommendation. So those are some other things. But in terms of the timeline, let's go back to the original question, is how long does it take? For the sake of discussion, let's assume for the moment that the person is signing the paperwork and the case manager is done with the paperwork. They are literally signing the last bits of things to go into the packet, scan. It's a digital routing that goes on. And they're going to hit the button and start that routing process. Because it's now digital, in some ways it does move a little faster, but in other ways, I think it gets slowed down in the institution. In the old days, it used to be literally a paper file packet that routed from desk to desk, and it got signed off and moved to the next person and kept moving. Until it got to the warden's office, the warden signed off on it. It went back to the unit secretary who put it in an envelope and mailed it to the reentry office. I used to say, tell people, plan for it to take 2 to 4 weeks to get through the institution. And then, depending on your mail, a week or so, maybe longer, and then plan for 6 weeks from the time it gets to the reentry office until you get a date back. So I used to tell guys on my caseload 6 to 8 weeks from when the time it's mailed from the institution. Now, how has that changed? It's 2026. It is sent digitally. So as soon as the warden hits the button with an electronic signature, it immediately goes to the reentry office. Now, what is the problem?
It sits in the box. It sits in the ComCore box.
But here it also, the case manager hits a button and it goes to the unit manager. And then the unit manager hits a button, it goes to the CMC and so on. So now it's not just sitting in one email box, it's sitting in multiple email boxes. And unless a person is very diligent, and each person along the route is very diligent about checking that incoming queue and moving things through, that those can get backed up. And that's unfortunate. I think when we were, it's kind of funny, you know, that balance between paper and electronic. You remember that I love it, the foreign language commercial. I cannot remember what country it was from, but it was a husband and wife arguing over paper versus digital, you know, the tablet versus the actual physical book, and writing letters versus emails and all that kind of fun stuff. And the very last scene, the husband is sitting in the bathroom on the toilet, yells to his wife for toilet paper, and she slides his tablet under the door with a picture of toilet paper. There's still this tension between what works better. And I think a lot of the younger case managers, the younger staff who are what we would call digital natives, you know, they've grown up not putting things in print and using the digital. I think those move through quicker, but as you get to maybe the folks in those kind of in between generations, what we call digital immigrants, those who didn't grow up using the electronics every day, we didn't start using it maybe until high school, maybe it was college, where we really started using computers more frequently, especially in high school. Sometimes out of sight, out of mind, and if they're not looking in their boxes. So I would say from the time, assuming that the case manager has finished the package and the only thing left is the individual signing off on that paperwork, I would probably give it closer to 8 to 10 weeks from then until a date comes back. And that is me being generous because I don't have a whole lot of faith in things getting stacked up in inboxes. That also presumes we're not in a government shutdown. That also presumes we're not in a heavy leave period where people are on holiday, school breaks and Christmas and stuff like that.
That said, and some of these dates that are coming back from the region, so even now might be incorrect or based on old computations. So definitely give us a call.
Yeah, absolutely.
If you feel like your loved one date came back and it's not accurate with what's saying on the computation sheet, so give us a call and then we can help sort that out. We're still in the business of doing that. We're still in the business of shaking the tree and getting people's stuff through the region. Go ahead.
One of the biggest things I think we're still seeing is halfway house packets that have actually been submitted too early. And we see this with individuals with shorter sentences. And if they're still in the 10-day earning rate and their paperwork gets submitted, what goes out has incorrect information in it. It goes out and then it comes back. It's got a date that's wrong by weeks. We've seen a couple as wrong as much as 2 months off. And it's because the paperwork was sent out too early. The case manager made the recommendation, wrote the paperwork up, submitted it based on the conditional release date at the time. But the conditional release date was based on the 10-day earning rate. All the time when we're talking to our clients that join our team, either in the pre-sentence, pre-arrival phase, or maybe early on before they actually start talking about halfway house, one of the specific things that we talk about is it is okay to, when your case manager starts talking about halfway house and you know you're still in that 10-day rate, it is okay to say, are you going to wait until my 15-day earning rate starts and I get my new conditional release date? If nothing else, it's reminding your case manager, my date's going to change again. And it's going to change to my favor. And I want to make sure I still get everything that's coming to me. Because the reentry offices are not going to stop and look up someone's conditional release date. They're looking on the paperwork. And if the paperwork has one date, and from the time the case manager hit the button and it routed through the institution and then the warden hit the button, their date changed. Or their date changed within days of it leaving the institution. That's a problem.
Right.
That's a problem.
All right. Two minutes. Two minutes.
Oh, two minutes. Okay. I'm going to say this really quick. We're really not going to be able to address this much. We did have a question. I saw a question about the impact of state charges. And the impact of state charges. State charges and unresolved pending charges will impact Second Chance Act halfway house placement. It can also impact or will impact, at least in the beginning, custody classification. If you are in that pre-trial phase, doing everything you can do to resolve the pending charges, to get them, make sure they're fully documented on the pre-sentence investigation report as resolved, is in your very best interest. If you are in the pre-trial phase or you're in the PSR phase and you've got a date set, you know, you're going to candidate state charges, you've got your sentencing hearing for the state on this date, make sure at least that information, even if the point of them doing the pre-sentence investigation report, it's not resolved, make sure that the information included is as current and accurate as possible. And if it changes, if it gets resolved in between when the report was written and when you're standing in front of the judge for sentencing, your lawyer should be getting that documented so that a report is amended so that the Bureau gets the most current information. I'm going to end it there. We can talk more about pending charges later today because that's a whole nother
deal. That'll be a good show.
Whole nother deal. Yes, document.
All right, folks. Am I still on? Can you hear me?
You are still on. You got to
Good deal.
In it.
I got a minute. Okay. Well, thanks everybody for coming to the show today. Don't always come by Apple Podcast. You can get our podcast there. You can go to the LA Talk Radio site, download the videos and the full podcast there for free, always for free. Don't forget to join our YouTube channel, First Step Act. A lot of these shows are on our YouTube channel. Also, Federal Prison Authority Around the Block has its own Facebook. A lot of these shows are on those as well. And of course, our flagship Facebook group, Early Release from Federal Prison, First Step Act. So lots of different touch points. If you have questions, don't hesitate to call us, reach out to us, direct message, email, or whatever. We'd love to work with you. So with that, have a great week, and we'll see you here next time on Around the Block. Take care, everybody.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to Federal Prison Authority Presents Around the Block with Bruce Cameron and Susan Giddings, only on LA Talk Radio.